Hello and welcome to episode 19 of the Wilder Podcast. In this episode, we interview Frank Holloman, the co-founder of Fork Ranger, who, along with his other co-founder, is on a mission to help people make more sustainable food choices. In the interview, we explore the surprising impact of food waste on the climate, the challenges associated with our reliance or over-reliance on meat and dairy, and we explore the importance of creating a social tipping point. Hello, Chloe.
Good evening, everybody.
Good evening. It might not be the evening.
I mean, that is true. It's just hard on my context, is it's dark outside.
And raining, I've just noticed, again. Anyway, welcome, listener, to the podcast. If you are new to this, probably worth recapping that we are the founders of The Grange Project. So we are a rewilding initiative in Monmouthshire, and we're actually coming up, aren't we, Chloe, to our one-year anniversary here on the site, on the farm. It's 80 acres, and this podcast is all about documenting our journey as we were complete amateurs a year ago, and we're now slightly less than complete amateurs, as we learn about the importance of nature recovery. And also, of course, we get some amazing guests on throughout the journey who help illuminate us on a variety of topics ranging from climate change, biodiversity loss, of course, rewilding, and others as well. Anything we think is particularly interesting to ourselves and we hope that our listeners will enjoy.
That's the great thing about having your own podcast. You can invite the cool people that you want to speak to onto it.
Yes. Before we go in, we've had lots of things happen. I'll give the bad news up front. Planning wise, we still haven't had a response about our education center we're hoping to build on site. Unfortunately, it's been delayed until the end of April, but you know, everything is still continuing to be positive in terms of the feedback we're receiving. So we've got our fingers and toes crossed for that one.
We're just now waiting on the biodiversity team, which adds another level of irony to our delay.
We've also just come back from a visit from our tiny homes that are being built, ready for hopefully the planning to come through. That was really good fun, and just seeing the inner lining, the reclaimed insulation going in, and ironically having more insulation than our Grade 2 listed farmhouse. But it is quite nice seeing the vision come together, isn't it?
It's amazing. And what I've so enjoyed about this process has been working with Sai of the Tiny Homes Company, where it feels like there's a really personal story behind each and every window that he's found, where the wood comes from for the cladding, the source of the little tiny log burner that's so cute. Like, it just feels like there's so many stories that go into that cabin, which is what makes it particularly special.
And then the final update, of course, we definitely couldn't get away with this episode without mentioning it, because it has been an absolute highlight to the year so far, is our Volunteers Day. Now that may be changing based on a blog that you've written, Chloe, but would you like to illuminate on the day briefly? And because there's a whole blog written, which will be in the show notes, I don't want to go into too much detail, but I'd love just to update the listeners on how it went and one of your key reflections or takeaways from the day.
So we put out the call about 2 months ago, asking if anyone wanted to come and help us do some rewilding. And it was fantastic. We got an amazing response. And on the day, we had 30 people turn up with enthusiasm, energy. And it was just such a joy because there was a huge range of ages, from 5 to people with a lot of experience, that came and helped us with a variety of different rewilding activities, whether it was brush pile creation, removing fences, planting trees. We had a little tour of the project and we ate some lovely food. And then there was the offer of the rugby afterwards, which quite a few people took up. And it was just a really fantastic day, which surprised me in so many ways, because I think we'd been so focused on the logistics in the lead up that we'd kind of lost sight of what it was actually going to feel like on the day and the emotion that it was going to generate. And there was a moment when I had my tea, I was looking out over the fields and there was someone with a sweat on removing a fence. There were some children hammering in stakes as part of a tree planting.
Fully risk assessed, like hastened out.
Of course, Tom, of course. And there were some other people sort of stopping and looking out over the skyline. And it was just such a wonderful feeling to have all these people coming together, working for a shared purpose. And the outcomes have been fantastic. They've really shifted my experience of those fields. Now they really feel qualitatively different.
Absolutely. I also just want to mention the team leaders or the activity leaders, because they took on responsibility beyond what they should really expect to do. So Ben, Dan and Jerry, thank you so much for everything you did on that day and everyone that turned up for it. And I just want to echo what you said, Chloe. I just didn't expect how it would feel. Even if I thought about it before the day, I would never have actually understood how it would feel until the day. And I think anyone that hasn't done any volunteering on a project such as a rewilding site, I really would recommend it, because it's just such a wholesome activity where everyone is trying to do something together for the greater good. There's no feeling like it. I certainly haven't felt it. And the last thing I'll say, spoiler alert from Chloe's blog, it's the changing the volunteer day term to a community day, I think is really important, because that's ultimately what we were. We were a community of people coming together, and we're hoping to continue to grow this Grange Project community. It doesn't matter if we have people from Kent, we have people hitchhiking from Welshpool all the way down, and local towns as well. And it doesn't matter where you come from, you know, once you've been here, you are now part of the community. And so we will have more community days going forward, which just fills me with such excitement and a little bit of concern around health and safety. Fine.
Yeah. There was slight anxiety from Tom the night before. He was busy writing his briefing. The military background was coming forward. But anyway, that's probably enough about the community day, which we were so delighted about. Shall we get started with the interview?
Right. Well, without further ado, here's Frank Holloman, the co-founder of Fork Ranger. This comes with a quick warning that Chloe and I definitely get a little bit overexcited with having Frank on, just because we've been using his products and services for the last year or so, and we've really enjoyed them. We're really happy that Frank chose to come on the podcast. So enjoy our genuine enthusiasm for the product going forward, but we do have a great chat, and throughout it's fascinating, but definitely towards the end, some of Frank's reflections on the importance of the journey and going on a journey and recreating the concept of the good life, but actually in a sustainable way, I just think is gold dust and worth listening to just for that. Here he is. Frank, welcome to the Wilder podcast.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be here.
I know the excitement is definitely, Chloe and I, is a little bit giddy, actually. In keeping with the tradition of the podcast, would you mind introducing yourself, your background, and what you find yourself doing?
Yes, of course. My name is Frank Holloman. I live in Amsterdam in the Netherlands, but I grew up in Switzerland, although I did have Dutch parents. And from a quite early age, I was interested in nature and also climate because, well, in Switzerland, you see those beautiful melting glaciers with your own eyes. And for a long time, I didn't really know what to do with my interest in climate and sustainability. I studied communication and did some work in graphic design. And then I found out that food plays a huge role in the whole climate discussion. And that's when I started Fork Ranger, which is a platform or organization to help people make sustainable food choices. And we do that with a book, an app. We have a seasonal calendar, and I do some speaking. Yeah, we try to make it easier for people to make the right choice and also to put it into practice, those choices. So that's my work now.
It's so exciting to have you on, Frank, because I know the Fork Ranger for, I don't know, maybe about 18 months or so, but it's really been in the last 6 months that we've kind of taken full advantage of all the services it provides. So everyone got seasonal calendars in their stockings at Christmas. I use the app on a daily basis, and it's like the infographics are beautiful, really accessible. The information you get from the app is brilliant. The recipes are great. I could go on, but like, I just want some appreciation because it's really changed how we eat here. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you. It's the best compliment that we could get. And also what keeps me going. It's seeing numbers doesn't really do that much, but hearing personal stories really brings the motivation to keep going.
And as this is an appreciation session from a marketing perspective, as people will know, I harp on about it, but it's so important for me to engage with something if I see that time and effort has been put into making it look and feel good, because that's the reality of the world that we're in. So, assuming, you know, Chloe and I have been on this journey for nowhere near as long as yourself. So would you mind kind of stepping back? And you made that fairly significant statement about the importance of food to climate. Would you mind kind of explaining, and I'm sure that's about five different podcasts worth of information, can you condense that down into a few minutes worth of why food has such an impact on climate, why we should take note of it?
Yeah, sure. So for me, the big realization came when I read Project Drawdown. They have a website, and it's a whole project, but they also have a book, and they calculated solutions for climate change. So they looked at 80 different solutions, everything from electric cars to windmills, and they calculated how much CO2 each solution can save. And that was a very refreshing way to look at it, because it's not only about where do emissions come from, but where can we save the emissions to stay below the 1.5 degrees or warming? And what was a really big surprise to me was that from those top 25 solutions, 11 are about food. And the top solution in their updated calculation is reducing food waste. That's above windmills, solar panels, electric cars, all of that. And the other top solution that is at spot number 3 is a plant-rich diet. And both of those are completely related to our habits, to what we eat. and how we deal with food, whether we appreciate it or we waste it. And that for me was a complete eye-opener, that such a big part of the climate solution comes from just our personal habits around food. And the reason that these two solutions take such a high spot is because generally one third of all emissions come from the food system. A small part of that is fossil fuels, but most of it comes from how we use land and the emissions that arise from that. So generally, climate change is 3/4 fossil fuels and 1/4 land use. And the really big majority of that land use comes from food production. The main thing that determines this land use is what we eat. Of course, how we produce that food also matters, but a bigger majority of it is really what we eat. And so that is why food, and especially our diets and what we choose to eat, has such a big impact on the climate.
Thank you for explaining that so clearly. Coming back to food waste, I'm just trying to clarify what that means in my head, because if I have a meal and half it goes to waste, how's that affecting the climate? And does that mean, so are they talking about basically just buying less food and therefore redistributing it to where it's actually needed? What are they suggesting?
Yeah, that's a good question. On the one hand, it feels very natural that wasting food is not good. On the other hand, it's quite complicated to figure out, like, how does this affect climate change? But it's exactly what you said. It's if we cook a meal and we waste half of it, it means that we need to go out and buy more food the next day to eat something again. Instead of eating maybe those leftovers for lunch, we go out and buy a new meal, which then increases the total amount of food that we need to produce, which means that we produce more food than necessary, which means that we produce more food emissions than necessary. We take up so much of the Earth's land to produce food, and we need to, because we need to feed ourselves. Of course, we could reduce it in some ways, but then we need to make a little bit of a sacrifice and use land for growing food, and then we end up not eating it. That's really the waste of it.
Now, it happens a lot, significantly more, I guess, in the Western world. You know, we do have a few listeners over in the US, so I do apologize that you may take this very, it's a very general statement, but my time over in the US when I was over there for work, I was shocked by that culture of it's okay to order loads of food, get halfway through the meal and go, yeah, that's me done, happy days, move on. And I sat there next to my American colleagues just going, I can't believe what I'm seeing. And it wasn't like it happened just once and the guy was having a bad day. That was his culture, just to do that. And I'm not saying that one guy in America is indicative of the whole of the United States. Whereas my background is that meal, I am going to eat that whole meal. I'm going to do it unless I am dying and I can't possibly fit any more in. But that's just, again, the way that I was brought up. And it's fascinating how just this culture has such an impact on it.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's why portion sizes matter, of course. And I do think that this is something that in the US, portion sizes are just bigger. But also in Europe, we waste a surprising amount. And in Western countries, most of the food waste happens at the consumption stage. So that means restaurants, but also in our own homes. It's surprising how much we waste. And I think a big reason is because we simply can afford to. If a bread has become stale and no longer as nice to eat as a fresh loaf of bread, we can afford to throw it away and buy a new one, but we really can't afford it from a climate perspective.
I think it's really interesting, this discussion, Frank, because I've been thinking a lot about food waste, because I think we try and be really careful about, we eat a lot of leftovers, I freeze a lot of stuff. Like, I don't feel like there's much what I typically describe as good food going to waste in our family. But things like peeling carrots, like, do you need to peel the carrot? And also I found a really interesting infographic you provided around whole grain, really interesting in terms of actually, if you're eating white bread, then there's been food waste from the rest of the grain. You probably explain it better than I will. But if you're eating the brown bread, then you're getting both the health benefits, but also there's less food waste. And I guess the same thing goes for there's a movement in the UK around wonky veg and being able to eat food that might not be supermarket standards of beauty, but actually still tastes just as great. And how do we kind of encourage people to consider food waste at different parts of the system as well as obviously not throwing away your perfectly good dinner that you could just have for leftovers the next day.
You touch on a lot of good points. For example, peeling carrots. Most of the times it's not necessary. A lot of nutrition is in the peels and it is food waste in a way then. But this is not the biggest problem. So you can categorize food waste into different parts. Usually they talk about avoidable food waste. So that's really you've cooked a meal that's perfectly good food and you throw it away. Then there's partly avoidable food waste. So this is often the peels, potato peels is a big one. You can eat it, so it's partly avoidable. And then there's unavoidable food waste, which is, for example, banana peels. You can do some very creative ways to still turn them into food, but generally they're not edible. But the biggest problem is really in the avoidable food waste. It's really just a loaf of bread that's perfectly edible, pasta that you've cooked too much of, vegetables that you've bought and that are just rotting away. And generally, especially bread, but also meat and dairy that have a higher carbon footprint to produce and therefore also a higher footprint when you waste them.
I think what I really appreciate about what you're saying there, Frank, is I think sometimes it's really easy to get caught up in the minutiae and start beating yourself up for little things. I think you did a really nice infographic at Christmas around the impact of a Christmas tree and how actually in the wider context it's pretty negligible in comparison to all the other things. And one of the things I love on your app is you talk about how actually in some ways the most important thing you can do is try and encourage other people to make small changes in their diet rather than spending hours deliberating about whether you should eat the chicken or the cheese. Actually, the best thing you can do is try and encourage your friend to eat less beef. And I think I really like that about the app. It's really about kind of social and psychological change as well as thinking about personal dietary change.
And just going off infographics that I've seen from you, and again, it's just so interesting how powerful these infographics are because they're the things you really remember. At least I do. I'm very visual and I hate reading and love looking at pictures, go figure. So the one about where you ranked the kind of the impact of different types of food and, you know, where chicken sits on that graph was quite interesting versus cheese, for example. And, you know, I think that has nudged Chloe and I into the way that we changing our habits because we just thought, get rid of all meat. And you invariably end up using cheese more often, I think, to stock up the meal. And now we've seen that. We're now changing it slightly, still using cheese because cheese is delicious. And, you know, at this stage of our journey, we're not at a point where we want to phase out cheese, but we're just using it in different ways. And actually, sometimes chicken for us might be an okay option. And that's okay. So thank you for that as well.
Yeah, thanks. That was so fascinating and great to hear how people actually use the app and the infographics. And I think also what you just said is what we try to do. It's not about getting it perfect, but about, first of all, realizing that our habits around food matter a lot and that we can use them for a positive change. And then that positive change doesn't rely on getting it perfect all the time, but about doing something. We can't get it right as consumers. Not all the responsibility for solving the issues in the food system is with consumers and with individuals. But what we eat is definitely, for a big part, our responsibility. And with the choices we can make a big difference. And I think that's what we really try to do with Fork Ranger, is to at least get started, get going. And then that's what really matters, not getting it perfect.
Yeah, definitely. And I think historically we've used some vegan meal boxes and I found them, I've always enjoyed the meals, but sometimes they've been quite complicated to produce. There have been a lot of ingredients that I've not been that familiar with. I'm not so keen on the kind of meat alternative market, whereas I think with your app, you get some really lovely dishes that are more fruit and veg based, but aren't so complicated, and loads of really great tips, like just little things like grating the cheese. It's amazing how much flavor there is in cheese and how you don't need that much to get the same experience as like huge blocks of cheddar. And yeah, it's all the little tips that I think are fantastic.
It's coming to a little bit like a sales pitch for Fork Ranger here, which again, what we try to do on the podcast is just be honest. So you know, this is our honest opinion, I suppose. But bringing it back to, you know, science, you mentioned about the impact. Well, let's talk about the impact of some things like, you know, beef, for example, and obviously having a bigger impact carbon footprint than plant-based solutions. There'll be a significant proportion of listeners that will already understand the science behind that and why it is there and why animals are just less efficient. But it would be really useful, I think, for the other half of our listeners to really go back to that basics and just to build from the foundations there so they understand.
Yeah, so the biggest factor is land use. And the amount of land that we need for food is also captured in the numbers around carbon footprints. But how it works is if you feed a cow, you need a lot of land to grow grass. But also in most cases in Europe and the US, it's not only grass, but it's also maize and sometimes some soybeans as well that the cows eat. And you need a lot of land to grow that food, and it would be much more efficient to just eat the soybeans and the maize ourselves, or to use that land to grow something else than maize and soybeans, to grow food directly for humans. You need a lot less land, and therefore also it has a lower carbon footprint. Now, the thing that is always a little bit complicated is that, okay, cows eat a lot of grass. Why is that bad for the climate? I think that's one of the most complicated discussions. But generally, in most cases, the grass should be considered farming and not nature because it is overgrazed. There's too many cows on the land. Also, you see that, especially here in the Netherlands, is that it is almost a monoculture of grass. It's one type of grass. It has zero flowers. It gets synthetic fertilizer. So it's really more like a farm field rather than a grassland. And that's one reason why that grassland use also matters. And the other thing, why beef has such a high carbon footprint compared to other meat, and why cheese also, unfortunately, has a relatively high footprint, is because cows also burp methane when they digest food. And this is another powerful greenhouse gas that just comes straight out of the cow itself. And it has a relatively short lifetime. But in that lifetime, compared to CO2, it causes a lot more warming. And generally, so all the cows, I think off the top of my head, they cause about 1/3 of human methane emissions. So it is a significant part as well. So I think these are the two most important reasons why in particular beef has such a high footprint.
So playing devil's advocate here, and it may sound like a stupid question, but people would say, okay, but we need a balanced diet, and beef has high in protein and a bunch of other things, I might say. So is it possible to remove those kind of things from the diet and be able to still maintain that quality balanced diet with all the right proteins and minerals and vitamins, etc. in it?
Yeah, that's of course an important question. The only thing that you cannot get from a purely vegan diet, or that it's at least very difficult to get, is vitamin B12. Most people, if they eat 100% plant-based, they take a supplement and then they're fine. It's often also argued that, well, meat is already supplemented with B12, so we might as well just eat it ourselves. But generally, yes, you can get all the essential nutrients. So, of course, there's quite a few documentaries that make the case that you need to go 100% plant-based to get the full health benefits. That's not what you find in the scientific literature. There is definitely room for animal-based products. And an ideal health and sustainable diet does include meat and dairy, but in much lower quantities than we eat currently. Especially, for example, the one thing that's interesting is iron, especially for women, can be beneficial to eat red meat once in a while for iron levels. But you don't need it on a daily basis, but more on a weekly basis. And the thing that most people worry about with protein, you don't need meat for protein. The average European and American already eats too much protein right now, but they don't eat enough fiber. And they also eat too much saturated fat. And, well, animal products don't have fiber, but they're high in saturated fat. And plant-based products are high in fiber and low in saturated fat. So generally, that's why it just makes a lot of sense from also a health perspective to follow the famous quote of eat food, not too much, mostly plants.
That's a great summary of a sustainable diet. I think it's a hard thing, isn't it, to shift your mindset from I eat whatever I want to I eat vegan, but actually I eat less and I have meat as treat is a much easier step into it. And then I really appreciate that idea. And I guess just returning to the question of land use, so to check that I've kind of understood correctly, so that the problem with livestock generally is they take up a lot of land to eat grass, which has very little benefit for the environment. And it's not a super efficient way to get our calories because the animals have to eat a lot of grass to then produce the same amount of calories for us to eat than if we just ate the plant itself. Have I understood that correctly?
Yes, that's the basics of it. Then in some cases, people argue that, well, in some areas, nothing else grows but grass. So then it would make sense to put cows on there. So then you can still produce food instead of where otherwise no food would grow. And yes, this is one way it can work, but that's not how most of the time it works, because then there's too many cows on there, the grass is fertilized with fertilizer. And in a lot of cases, you can argue that it would be actually better for nature if it would just be a wild grassland rather than a farmed grassland. But of course, this is where it's complicated. And we also do say that there is room for animals in a sustainable farm system. It's just that the main issue right now is that we eat so much of it that this way of production, of seeing where do we have some grassland that we could put a few cows on it, is not enough. because the amounts of meat we need to produce to feed our current consumption is more than this. So we need the maize and soybeans to produce enough milk and meat. So if we reduce our levels to a lower amount, suddenly the meat that we do produce could be much more sustainable because we don't need to grow crops specifically for feeding them to animals.
I think that's another really good point, because you kind of forget that, don't you? Not only do the cows need to eat the grass, which isn't super efficient, but they also need to eat the maize and the corn, which is often grown sometimes in even worse contexts where it's deforestation. Is that correct?
Yes. So the most of the maize that cows eat in Europe comes from Europe, but it still takes up a lot of land that what wasn't forest 20 years ago, but it could be forest, and it was forest 200 years ago. And especially the soybeans, those often come from Brazil, where it causes the deforestation of the Amazon forest. And I do have to say that it's most of that soy goes to pigs and chickens, because their diet is pure maize and soybeans. While cows, they get a little bit extra for enough protein to produce enough milk most of the time. And so it is linked also to deforestation.
Yeah, so some people would suggest that maybe traditional farming methods like we discussed, where it has kind of heavy chemical use, or maybe has a high proportion of animals or livestock to the land available, has not been historically particularly nature friendly, shall we say. There is a new movement called regenerative agriculture. I'm keen to hear whether you think that movement itself can do what it says on the tin, which is not only produce, but also help to protect or restore nature going forward.
Yeah, right. And I think it's important to make also a distinction between the consumption side and the production side. So what we do at Fork Ranger is we focus on the consumption and all the advice that we give. So then our number one tip is to reduce beef, because that's the food that produces the most greenhouse gases. That's the number one tip if you start from consumption. But if you want to give farmers the number one tip, you would start from a completely different perspective. You might talk about what's the soil, what does the soil need? So I think this is where a lot of the disagreement happens, is because people talk about production and consumption in the same conversation, whereas they start from completely different points. And I definitely think that there is space for animal farming. If you start with, for example, what does the land need? What does the soil need? If you then come to the conclusion that it would be beneficial to have some cows on there, then it makes sense. It's just not, that's a different starting point than looking at how do we need to eat to reduce the footprint of our food.
I think it's a really helpful point. I mean, it's obvious, isn't it? But kind of thinking about the consumption, the production side as different conversations, because so often it's quite emotional, isn't it? Food and how we use our land, and farming is such a fantastic profession that is often underappreciated, I think, particularly in Europe, and how often a lot of the decisions that have been made in a farming context has been influenced by farming policy, as opposed to what perhaps an individual farmer would want to do with the land. So I think it's really helpful. And what's the hopeful story about food moving forward in terms of its relationship to climate change?
Yeah, there's a lot of hope. On the one hand, it's about reducing all the bad stuff, so the deforestation, but also the health issues. A lot of them are intertwined. We eat too much. We eat too many of the unhealthy foods. We eat too much meat and dairy, which is not only using too much land, but also bad for our health. So I think that's something I'm excited about, is that healthy and sustainable food touches so many parts of our lives. The other thing that I found that I got excited about is, of course, eating less meat and dairy. It's simple, but it's not always very easy, because we're stuck in old habits. But once you learn a few new recipes, you also discover completely new flavors. There's a lot of exciting things you can do when you put vegetables at the center of the plate. And that requires some new cooking ideas or recipes. But then there is a lot of new flavors. So that's another thing I'm excited about. And I think also with regenerative agriculture, that just the idea that you can over time improve something rather than just being less bad. So in a lot of cases with sustainability, it's about doing what we need to do, but in a way that's less bad for people and environment. But with farming, there's things we can do to even improve the land and improve the soil and improve biodiversity over time. And for me, this whole idea that our food, I always saw food as something a bit boring, and I never wanted to work in food, actually. And I wanted to be out there, be an explorer in the mountains or whatever. And now I see that food is our connection to the landscape and to nature. And of course, we always have to find the balance between sort of 100% pure wild nature and cultivated land where we grow food. And that is not an easy discussion, but it's an exciting one. And it can produce delicious products and also a beautiful landscape. And I think that whole part is what gives me a lot of hope. And also it's something we do every day. So it's sort of food doesn't need another purpose. Sort of food is something of is a goal in itself. A lot of things we do in life, or like cars, for example, electric cars, they're not a goal in itself. We just need to get to a place, and maybe electric cars can do it better than fossil fuel cars, but maybe less well than bicycles for some reasons. But with food, it's just that's a goal in itself of having healthy and delicious food. And I think that's something I'm very excited about.
I think I'm going to invite myself over to your house for dinner because I'm just imagining the flavors. But bring it back again, just to get your response to it. What would you say to someone who says, yes, but me not having a steak is not going to nudge any dial when it comes to climate change? Do you have a kind of position or opinion on that?
Yeah, I think this is a very common feeling, is that sort of what do my choices really matter, especially in the context of big oil companies just going about their business. It's a reaction that I get a lot on social media. And I think what's important is that it's not either or. It's not either stopping big corporates or changing my diet. It's both. But from all the things we can do as individuals, food is one of the things that really matter. It's not only in our lives usually the area that has a huge carbon footprint, but it's also the one that we ourselves have direct influence over. And sometimes we cannot change our house and how it's insulated or what type of heating we need, but everyone can decide what they eat.
And for me, it's that sending a signal. It's if you go out for a meal and you do pick the delicious looking vegetarian, vegan option, and it's delicious and you have a wonderful meal, you're sending that buying signal to the producers and to the restaurant or whatever that this is the way that things are moving. And they will then start to pick up on that, and then they'll start changing their menu and rebalancing it. And I think that's really quite powerful. So I think, you know, it's important to not become disempowered or whatever it might be when it comes to these kind of decisions. Consumers, we're in a capitalist society, so your buying habits really will change it. And I was speaking to a friend of mine who works for one of these massive blue chip organizations, and they were just saying they haven't yet received enough buying signals from the consumer to change some of their frankly inappropriate habits. And that's sad to hear, but also nice to hear that it's actually in our control to be able to influence them going forward.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the other thing to realize is that we don't need to convince the majority of the population to give up their steak to make a difference, because there's some research that suggests that if you get 25% of a population to change the norm and the status quo, then the rest will follow even if it goes against their interest. So you need to get this momentum to this tipping point, and from there everything will start moving. So I think that's what's really important to realize, is that you hear a lot of negativity and a lot of polarization. You see the negative comments on social media, but those people are usually the 10% on the one extreme. And in the middle is a large silent majority of people who are sort of doubting what they should do. Maybe they're open to it, but they haven't changed something yet. And our goal should be to just grow the movement. And we don't need to convince everyone. We just need to get to a tipping point where the government is no longer afraid to take action, where businesses are also coming along because they see that enough people want it. And with food, because food is something social, and what you eat has a subconscious influence on the people around you. So in that way, it's not only the fact that replacing a steak with cooking a delicious curry with lentils saves a few kilos of CO2, that matters as well, but it's also the social change that you power forward when you make that choice over and over. And that also means that with food, that you don't need to get it perfect, but what you do over 365 days a year, that really adds up. So just having one meal doesn't make a big difference, but doing it over and over again, it creates a big change.
I think that's a really helpful reminder about the social tipping point and the power of the social change. One little thing connected to that is, historically, when we used to have people over for dinner, even though we were eating more plant-based during the week, I would sort of feel, we've got friends coming over, therefore I should produce meat at the weekends because that's what everyone wants. And now I try and do the opposite. Actually, I think, what is my best vegan or veggie recipe that I can share with people so that they can have an experience of hopefully something delicious if it goes well? Then that becomes part of that kind of social change. And one of the things I think is a bit problematic, which I'd be interested in your reflections on, is I find it hard to describe how we eat because, I mean, we're not vegetarian and we're not vegan. And I feel like those are sort of labels that can be quite restrictive, because I'm a vegetarian sort of means something very, or vegan beans, something quite specific. But so I guess I try to think, oh, we eat sustainably. I don't know, there's a better phrase. I know some people talk about a reducetarian, like eating less meat.
Yeah.
I don't
why,
know.
Why label it?
Because I think it's part of identity. It becomes part of who you are. And then we can connect to other people that have a similar story. And that's part of the social movement. I think having, sometimes we need labels as part of that.
I agree, but it's also quite polarizing. And actually, if you just make it a norm, then it's just, you're coming to our house, we're going to feed you food. This is delicious food, enjoy the food. And I just want to go back to one thing you said, Chloe, and I think it's important to note that you skipped a few steps, I think, in our journey, our evolution to eating less meat. And I think it's really important to note that we actually went from eating quite a heavily meat-based diet, let's say, through to going, okay, we want to reduce it. We want to have a less impact, a lower impact. And therefore, we decided to eat less meat during the week. But we did, at the weekend, look forward to our friends coming over, having a meal that was focused around meat and was delicious, and our friends enjoyed it. And that became a really enjoyable ritual because we looked forward to it more because we weren't having it during the week. And it was special because we probably sourced the meat from a certain location that there was a story to it. And we could then share it with our friends. And I felt that was a really important stepping stone, certainly for me, on this journey. And I want people listening to this who may have a very heavily meat-based diet to know you don't just go from that to what you were suggesting. And we didn't do that either. So that makes sense?
Yeah, I love that. And that's also what we say, is that it's not about giving up all meat and dairy, but about making it a luxury product, making it something special, almost a bit like chocolate. It's not something that you have in huge quantities.
Unless you're in this household.
But it's something that you treat yourself with, that you can also enjoy in small quantities. It's about getting the flavor and the story with it rather than sort of the bulk of your food. And then I do have that dilemma. When I got married 2 years ago, we had a discussion about, should we serve meat at the wedding because it's a very special day?
Yeah.
Or should we serve a plant-based meal because all these people are coming and it's a great opportunity to show them how delicious it can be? In the end, we went for the second option also because it was a lot cheaper. So that was another benefit. And yeah, a lot of people loved it. They tried something they had never eaten before and they were very excited about it. Thanks for adding that. I think it's an important point.
It looks like it's that time again and we're coming to the end of the conversation. Frank, thank you very much for your time. I've got a last question. And I love that these questions that we ask are, you know, full books in themselves in order to answer them. So I do apologize for it. We're trying to fit it into a 40-minute chat. But I'm just interested in your perspective about how best do we achieve that systemic change? How best do we get to the tipping point faster of that 25% we discussed? And I've got one reflection before I come to you is from my perspective, seeing the power of our children coming home and basically holding us accountable to whatever they've learned that day, I think is really powerful for us because, you know, the way that we want to be perceived by our children is obviously, you know, want to be positively perceived. So I'd love to see a change in the curriculum where they get taught modules, you know, each year throughout the whole time at school, where they just understand the science, the impact of our consumerist lifestyle so that people can be informed. So, you know, who knows, maybe they do go home and start asking questions about why we're having beef, why not X or Y. Anyway, that's my perspective on it. I'm keen to hear kind of your thoughts.
Yeah, well, it's funny, my wife is a primary school teacher, so I do think that's an important part of the puzzle as well. But generally, what I focus on is trying to envision what it will look like if we achieve this transition. So we always talk about sort of the things we need to do less of, less meat, less consumerism, less buying. And to a lot of people, that sounds like less fun in life, which is not the point. It's not that we should get rid of all the good stuff in life. It's about changing our focus on the things away from the things that are very polluting and focusing on the things that really matter. So I always say less meat, more plants, but also less stuff, more memories. And also, for example, with another painful one, less flying, but more adventure. And the adventure can be regardless of where you are. And for me, that's sort of, I think, the most important part of what we need to do more of in this whole climate movement, but also with sustainable food, is focusing on the thing that we can get in return for it. Because it's very rewarding to be on this journey of trying to have a positive impact on the world instead of just reducing your negative part. Of course, there's always both. But for me, that's sort of how I always call it, is I'm sort of trying to explore a new version of the good life.
Yeah.
Right now, the good life is characterized in shopping and eating junk food and maybe having a huge mansion with a pool, flying to a tropical island. It's sort of all this stuff. But deep down, we know that these things are not what makes us happy. And what does make us happy is relationships and also nature. And so how can we slowly change our lives in ways that it's not focused on all this consumerism, but on the things that matter? And I think that's where food plays a huge role in it, because again, it's an end in itself. It's something enjoyable. And if we can use that thing, this enjoyable moment, to do something good with it, then it's a win-win-win.
Yeah, absolutely. I like what you said there around it's a journey, because I think Chloe and I really are on that journey. And you know, we're new to this journey and it isn't easy. It's not just you click your fingers, you change your mindset, you move on. You keep on falling back into old ways. At least I find myself doing that when you speak to your friends who are not quite as far along the journey and they're off doing X, Y, and Z, or their business is being super successful, or whatever it ends up being. I'm very happy for them. I also then get that competitive nature and I feel like that's where I should be. Chloe and I made that conscious decision to step away from doing the things that we felt were not contributing to a positive world and try and refocus our efforts on something we can leave the world in a better place than when we arrived in it. But it definitely isn't easy. And we definitely haven't clicked off fingers and we're not in this new promised land yet.
I think seeing it as a journey is super important. And also realize, because a journey means that you're moving along. Maybe you don't know exactly sort of what's behind the horizon. So what the ideal situation or ideal sustainable food system looks like. And we don't have to. All we need to know for now is sort of what direction to head towards. And we know more than enough to start heading that direction. And the worst thing that could happen is that we discuss so much about what the perfect situation looks like that we forget to start working. And I think that's why this journey metaphor works very well.
Thank you, Frank. That's been really, really useful, very interesting, and absolute pleasure chatting to you. Long may you continue doing your thing, and I look forward to seeing the company and organization grow around what you're doing. I think it's great. Listeners, if you are interested in anything we've discussed, and especially around Fork Ranger, all the links will be in the show note. But even more excitedly, we've got a little discount for you. You've got 10% off any of the Fork Ranger products. If you type in Grange, as you're buying it, you'll get 10% off, and everything goes to the Fork Ranger to continue doing what they do.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
There were lots of things that I really appreciated about the episode, but I think one of the first ones that I want to touch on is how often we get this message of eat less beef and plant-based diet being really important. And I think I was kind of aware of that message, and I had made changes incrementally prior to connect with the Fork Ranger as a result of that. But what I really liked about this episode is that Frank really helped us to understand some of the science behind those messages, which for me helps me make more sense and understanding of why we're making the changes, not just that I should be making the changes.
Yeah, I also liked the way it was communicated, again, very clearly and, like you say, very scientifically, and maybe without any of those traditional biases or judgments that people may feel or expect coming from someone who's saying become a vegetarian or vegan or eat less meat or whatever. So I feel it's really accessible and non-judgmental, which is very important for this debate and discussion going forward.
Yeah, and the message he gave was actually quite a simple one, and it's all about incremental change, isn't it? Just making small changes and seeing how it feels. I really like this concept of there's no such thing as a perfect environmentalist, that it's all about heading in a direction of travel and talking about that direction of travel and not aiming for perfection.
Listeners, I know that I talk about the importance of just being informed, even if you don't make any decisions or changes to your diet, but you've understood the science behind it and you are an informed eater, then that's a positive step forward regardless. And I like that. And that's what his infographics do for me. It just simple to understand,
simple to quickly scan and learn a takeaway from it. And it's micro learning, as someone might call it, I suppose. And I think that works really well in social media. I think they're doing such a great job, few better, in fact, I think, for that level of influence.
Yeah, it definitely sets me off on the right foot every morning. I wake up at 7 o'clock. I get my little, are you ready for your Fork Ranger question? I get to answer the question.
What kind of questions do they ask you? Because I feel a lot of pressure at 7 o'clock in the morning when a Fork Ranger question pops up.
Shall I let you know what my question was this morning?
Go on then.
Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
Diversity on a farm is important because it A, makes farming more efficient, B, requires less energy to harvest, or C, creates healthier plants.
I mean, I'm going to go for C.
That is the correct answer. So then you get a little detail about why, and it gives you some explanation. Do you want to know the explanation, or we're not that invested?
I am that invested, but we're, you know, people's time is valuable, Chloe.
Fine. Well, you can go on the app to find out the answer to this. But what I particularly enjoy is that I've unlocked a recipe. So the recipe I've unlocked today is beetroot and pumpkin curry.
Excellent. I'm sure we'll be enjoying that at some point in
Absolutely.
The next week. So.
Sounds about right.
So that's about all from me, Chloe. Anything from you?
No, just to thank you, Frank, for his time and insights.
If you've got this far in the podcast, thank you so much. I hope you're still continuing to enjoy what we're doing as much as we are. Now, there is something you can do. I do say this most episodes, is rating review. It is something that if you just stop now and quickly flip onto your phone, go onto Spotify or iPlayer and leave a quick review, it allows us to shoot up through the charts, which then allows us to be found by other people, which hopefully allows them to benefit from some of the amazing guests that we get on. It is super important. I can't stress that enough. So if you do get the time, we'd really appreciate it. Right, until next episode.
Good night, everybody.
Or afternoon, or have a great walk. I don't know.
Sorry, Tom, I love it again.